If you ask what they wish they knew more about, you find out about their curiosities and unfulfilled interests. If you hit on a strong interest, like taste in movies or books, you can dig deeper into why they like what they like and find out how introspective they are. Even if you think you know your partner well, the answers might surprise you. What's something you love to do? Do you have a favorite place? Is there a book or movie you've read or seen more than once? What is occupying your thoughts most at the moment? What's something you wish you knew more about? What's the best meal you've ever had? This isn't an interview. Every conversation has two sides. And one aspect of your partner's personality these questions will reveal is whether they're curious about you. Do they ask for your own responses to these questions and dig deeper when they turn the conversation to you? Try this. Prepare for date one. Take the questions I suggested you ask your date and write out your own answers to them. What's something you love to do? Do you have a favorite place? Is there a book or movie you've read or seen more than once? What is occupying your thoughts most at the moment? What's something you wish you knew more about? What's the best meal you've ever had? Once you have your answers, ask yourself what they might tell a person about you. Do these questions bring up some of your strong interests? Do they give you a chance to reveal important aspects of your personality? If not, are there other questions that would? Add those questions to the list you bring to your next date. Date 2. Your date 2 could come after any number of dates spent dancing or going to the museums or talking casually over dinner. But knowing that you enjoy the same movies or like the same cuisine doesn't really tell you if your values are compatible. Gently encourage your date to share meaningful stories and details about their life. Take turns with these questions and make sure again that it's not an interview. In fact, if they hesitate over a question, you might say, "I know it's a hard question. I'll go first." Your answers can reveal your own values. If the question is who's the most fascinating person you've ever met, don't just give a name. Say what interested you about the person, what you learned from them, or what you would ask them if you could meet them again. If you're telling a story about something you've done that's out of character, then tell them what's in character for you, why you hold that value, and what made you diverge from it. If they're not immediately open, that's okay. Escalating self-disclosure is a slow build. Sometimes when we're ready to share, we think it's the right time for them to open up as well. But people do this at their own pace, in their own time. Ask questions and listen carefully to the response to gauge if the person is hesitant. Give them openings to change the subject, asking, "Is this too heavy a topic? Or would you rather not go here right now?" Not only do we want to avoid grilling our date, we also don't want to overshare, taking up all the oxygen in the room with unsolicited, deeply personal stories will only make the person feel overwhelmed. Your ability to be vulnerable and open will help them be vulnerable and to share what feels comfortable at this stage. Here are some uncommon questions you can try out on date 2 that will help you learn what they find interesting, how they deal with challenges, what they value, how they tolerate risk, and how they make decisions. Who's the most fascinating person you've ever met? What's the most out-of-character thing you've ever done or would like to do? Have you ever had a big plot twist in your life? If you won the lottery, what would you spend the money on? What's the most spontaneous thing you've ever done? What is a tough thing you dealt with in your past? What makes you proud? What would you do if you had enough money to not need a job? Notice how all these questions approach deeper issues without pressure or intensity. You're not asking the worst moment of someone's life or what their darkest secret is. These questions are framed to learn about the other person, but in a playful way. Don't treat your opinions as if they're better than your partner's. They're just different viewpoints that emerge from different backgrounds, different experiences, different upbringings. Date 3. Date 3 should occur when it feels natural to share some of your ideas for the future. Just as you don't need to share the same values, you don't need to have the same goals. One of you might have your whole life mapped out, and the other might still be exploring what gives their life meaning. On date 3, you can try out some deeper questions. I'll share some here. Do you have a dream you'd like to fulfill one day? A job, a trip, an accomplishment? What would you like to change about your life? If you could meet anyone, who would it be? Is there a single moment or experience that changed your life? Is there someone you consider to be your greatest teacher? Using the information you glean on these 3 dates, you can determine if you like a person's personality, respect their values, and want to help them pursue their goals. Notice the verbs I chose here. You don't have to have the same personality so long as you enjoy each other. You don't have to share their values so long as you respect them. Their goals don't even have to be things you want or enjoy. But are you interested in having these aspects of who they are and who they want to be as part of your day-to-day life and coming to pass near or alongside you? Certain goals, like robbing a bank, should be deal breakers. It might be that you like them so much that you'd be excited to help them with anything, within reason, that they want to pursue. Or if their goal is to eradicate homelessness in Los Angeles, such a noble goal might in itself make them more attractive. Attraction leads to dreams. When our attraction to a person continues over time, we start to fantasize about the relationship that could develop. What adventures we could have with this person. What our life together would look like. We find ourselves in phase 2. Phase 2. Dreams. In the second phase of love, many of us move fast. Our attraction to this person tells us that they might match our dreams. But our dreams can cloud our vision of the other person and our own needs. In this phase, we strive to dismantle false expectations and focus on designing, building, and nurturing a strong relationship based on realistic expectations rather than intoxicating dreams. False expectations. In this phase of love, we often have in mind a checklist of the qualities our partner should have. Sometimes these are very specific and/or tied to the opulences. Successful, owns a home, likes to watch basketball, is a certain age or a certain level of fitness, is ready to get married in the next year. Psychologist Lisa Firestone says these unrealistic expectations are exaggerated by technology. Online dating sites can promote the overwhelming notion that there are endless choices in the world, leaving some of us to get stuck in a cycle of perpetual searching or what one team of researchers called relation shopping. We may unintentionally find ourselves seeking perfection or one person who can fill every imaginable criterion we've created in our mind or on our profile. This list making can turn dreams into requirements. Any potential partner will come with a past, challenges, and possibly trauma just as you do. You simply won't find someone who ticks every box on your checklist. It's okay for different people to fill the different needs on your checklist. Research shows that the happiest people have multiple close relationships. So whether we're coupled or single, we shouldn't look to any one person to meet all our needs. John Cacioppo, a neuroscientist who researched love and affection, told the New York Times, "One of the secrets to a good relationship is being attracted to someone out of choice rather than out of need." We might also hope that our partner wants the same things in life that we do. The same standard of living, the same family structure, the same likes and dislikes, the same friends, the same notions of how money should be saved and spent, the same plans for the future in terms of how hard we will work, how successful we will be, where we will live, how we will handle unexpected challenges, and how frequently we will make changes. Even if we don't say this or even think it, we subconsciously believe that we must share the same values and goals to be in love. When one person wants to spend Sunday with their family and the other wants to play golf, or he wants to meet her friends but she's not ready, they can rashly take it as a sign that they're not meant to be. Or later in a relationship, if they don't want to move when we do, we might take it to mean that they don't love us. And if they don't want to get married when we do, we think it's the end. It's also not uncommon in this phase to expect our partners to read our minds, to understand as soon as we speak, and to agree with us. We expect them to channel our emotions and desires, to select the gift we crave, to intuit how we want to celebrate our birthday, what we want for dinner tonight, how much attention we want, how much space we need. But creating something together is better than wanting the same thing. How you handle your differences is more important than finding your similarities. In phase two, we ground our dreams in reality by establishing rhythms and routines that create the space to nurture the relationship slowly and carefully. Rhythms and routines. Instead of chasing the dream of what it might be to live happily ever after with this person, spend time getting to know them, building your connection. Dreams are an illusion. Reality is far more interesting. In corporate settings where systems are strong, I urge leaders to incorporate sentiment in order to soften the rigidity of organization and process. And in relationships where sentiment is strong, I embed systems to help bring structure and order to the emotional landscape. Rhythms and routines help us maintain a steady pace that lets us get to know each other gradually and genuinely. We acknowledge that we are both looking for a long-term relationship and hoping this is it. When we establish rhythms and routines together, instead of trying to meet false expectations, our relationship is grounded in how much time we'll spend together and how we'll spend it. We don't have to wonder when the person we're interested in will call us next. We don't play games like waiting a certain number of days before returning their call. We also start to set healthy boundaries while observing how our partner responds to them. Boundaries can be physical. Some people choose to take their time becoming sexually intimate, and they can also relate to time and emotions. A small survey conducted by High Touch Communications, Inc. found that after work hours, most people expected friends, family, and romantic partners to respond to a text within 5 minutes. But when it came to work hours, they gave friends and family an hour but still expected a romantic partner to respond within 5 minutes. "I've learned to give Radhi around 5 days, with a reminder." Clinical psychologist Seth Myers advises new couples to exercise caution. In Psychology Today, he writes that lots of physical interaction right away heightens emotions and can color how you see the other person. Looking at them through rose-colored glasses could make you overlook red flags that would be more apparent or concerning if you weren't under the influence of the bonding chemicals we release as a result of physical contact, especially sex. Plus, you're forcing emotional intimacy with someone you barely know. And as Myers points out, if you don't really know the person eliciting those intense emotional reactions, you may put yourself at risk. If the person is kind and good and wants the same things as you, there's no problem. If the person doesn't have the same relationship goals as you, you may end up feeling lonely and betrayed. He recommends that for at least the first month, you see one another no more than once a week. And if things are going well, then you can slowly dial up the frequency of your dates. When you encounter a new potential friend, for example, you probably don't rush to see that friend several times per week after you first meet, Myers writes. Why should the guidelines for starting a romantic relationship be so different? The time and space we spend apart enhances the time we spend together. We want to find a balance among time together, time alone, time with our own friends, and time with collective friends. In a week, you might decide to spend one night alone, three nights together, two nights with friends that you both know, and one night with your own friends. This gives you time together, time to decompress, time to experience other people's energy together, and time to decompress in a different way with your own friends. When you do this, you should tell your partner why it's important to you to structure your time this way. Merely saying, "I need alone time," leaves them wondering what they've done wrong, while saying, "I need alone time because I'm stressed out," gives them a chance to be supportive and understanding. The schedule I just shared is an example, but it gives you an idea of how to think about your own. Try this. Set a schedule. Together, work out how often you talk, message, and see each other. Find an easy rhythm and healthy ratio that works for both of you. Decide how you want to divvy up your free time. Not every week has to be the same, but when you have a sense of how you're going to spend your time, you don't feel that you're in a competition with other interests. Nights by yourself, nights together, nights with mutual friends or family, nights with your own friends. Instead of setting rhythms and routines, we often worry or wonder where the relationship is going or complain to our friends about it. We're afraid to have conversations with a partner because we don't want to put pressure on them or to be perceived as needy. But conversations about what feels right to both of you at this point are entirely appropriate. When you have these conversations, the other person may not respond the way you hoped. Their pace and commitment may be different from yours. This doesn't mean the relationship is doomed. It means you can proceed with more clarity. And if these topics scare someone off, you haven't made a mistake. You've saved yourself the weeks and months you might otherwise have spent waiting for the relationship to play out. Instead of wondering why they never call, do this. Set a time to connect rather than leaving it up to hope or chance. Instead of thinking they're too busy for you, discuss how busy/available you are in the upcoming week. Instead of thinking they're moving too quickly, tell them you'd like to move at a slower pace, but it doesn't mean you're not interested. Instead of thinking they're moving too slowly, tell them you want to make sure you've got the same aspirations. Instead of worrying because they haven't introduced you to their family or friends, learn about their closest relationships by asking questions and finding out who is important to them and why. Instead of wondering if they're seeing other people, ask them if they want to be exclusive and hear them out. In these conversations, you may not always like what you learn. If the person doesn't react or respond in the way you wanted, it doesn't mean this relationship won't work. It means you can move forward in one direction or another with clarity. Phase 3. Struggle and growth. We are meant to fall in love, be in love, and stay in love. But we can't do any of that if we expect every day to be Valentine's Day. Trouble is inevitable. It comes when, as a couple, we inevitably discover the various ways in which we aren't aligned. In phase 3, we confront those differences and disappointments and figure out if we want to put in the effort that resolving or living with them requires. When I was a monk, as you might imagine, we did a lot of self-reflection. And at one point, my teacher asked a group of us to rate how much we were struggling with our minds on a scale of 1 to 10. Our work was intense, and we all gave ourselves pretty high struggle ratings. Then he said, "Well, imagine if there were two minds trying to get along. Two different people from different households with their own beliefs, values, expectations, and dreams. There is no way this experiment can run smoothly. Love means that you value your partner enough to confront difficult areas. Relationships are masterfully designed to annoy us. It's easier on your own when there's nobody around to question you or bear witness to your flaws. But that's not why you're in a relationship. Bringing awareness to your relationship is uncomfortable. Many couples bump up against an opportunity for realization and feel it as a burden. We expect love to flow naturally, but this is extremely rare, and often it means that we're not taking on the tougher issues. We need to make mistakes, identify what we need to change, and work on doing better. This is where we grow as individuals and together. Many of these challenges are simple and domestic. For example, in my house growing up, we ate dinner, had dessert, hung out and talked for a while, then cleaned up. In Radhi's house, they ate dinner, cleaned up, had dessert, and only when everything was all done would they relax into conversation. When we first started entertaining as a couple, after dinner, Radhi would clean up on her own, and I felt guilty that I wasn't helping. I always said that I'd clean a bit later, and I meant it. But she was locked into the ritual from her upbringing, and I was locked into mine. Someone might say they'll clean up later, and their partner might believe they're just being lazy. But more often, differences like this originate in backgrounds, cultures, and habits. The small hurdles are issues like she snores, he's always late, they would rather watch TV when I want to go to a museum, I can't stand her best friend, he wants to spend every holiday at his parents' home, they have 3 cats and I'm allergic. And there may be bigger hurdles like he has massive student debt. She has a temper that scares me. We have a long-distance relationship, and neither of us wants to move. She doesn't want to have children, and I do. Disagreements, large and small, may challenge your confidence in your bond. You may feel, "I thought I loved you, but..." In that situation, there are 3 routes you can take. 2 of them lead to important realizations. You can leave the relationship, in which case you realize this person doesn't suit your priorities. You can work through the issue together and grow, in which case you realize you're feeling positive enough about your bond to evolve together. Or you can stay together without changing anything, in which case you don't realize anything. I advise you not to make the 3rd choice. This phase is very important when it comes to defining love. Because you either realize that something is a deal breaker for you, or that you're willing to go through the growth that facing the issue involves. And if it's the latter, you will come through the experience with a stronger, more resilient love. We will discuss relationship challenges like these in more depth in Rules 5 and 6. Phase 4. Trust. After we've overcome a challenge together, we grow. We learn to tolerate, adjust, and adapt. The growth that we do together builds into trust. Evaluating the breadth and depth of your trust for someone is a way of understanding and defining your love in the fourth and highest phase. Sometimes we assume trust is binary. Either we trust someone or we don't. But trust increases gradually through actions, thoughts, and words. We shouldn't trust someone instantly just because they're kind to us. We give them our trust because little by little, day after day, we have shared more of ourselves and seen what they do with our honesty. All of the earlier phases build on one another to get us here. Trust begins with ourselves. We need to be trustworthy. This means aligning what we think, say, and do. When we think something, we express it, and then we carry through with the idea. This means we can trust ourselves. So if I feel like I need a night to myself, I communicate that to my partner, and then I take the time. I feel the benefit of the gift I've given myself, and I trust myself to take good care of myself. My partner sees me following through on my ideas, observes the results, and recognizes my trustworthiness. Then I do the same for my partner. I follow through on my promises to them. I show them that I'm trustworthy, and in doing so, inspire them to respond with an equal level of trust. We trust people more when they make us feel safe, when they make healthy decisions, when we feel like they conduct their life based on values that we agree with. To evaluate the depth and breadth of your trust for your partner, consider these three aspects: physical trust, mental trust, and emotional trust. Physical trust is when you feel safe and cared for in their presence. They want to be with you, they're present and attentive, and being around them feels good. Mental trust is when you trust their mind, their ideas, their thoughtfulness. You may not agree with every decision they make, but you trust the way they make decisions. Emotional trust is when you trust their values and who they are as a human. Do they treat you well? Are they supportive? Do you trust how they behave, not just with you, but with the other people in their life, from close friends to a waiter? It's okay if you don't have absolute trust for your partner across this spectrum, and they can make mistakes that challenge your trust. When you identify weak spots, consider how significant the weakness is. How does it affect you? If you don't trust them in areas that are important to you, you can give your partner grace and maintain trust by sharing honestly around the issues. It's impossible to have trust if there is dishonesty, secrets, or gaslighting. Trust builds very slowly and needs to be nurtured and sustained. Think of it as growing by percentage points. Each time someone thinks, says, and does the same thing, trust grows by 1 percentage point. In the beginning, you trust them to speak the truth about whom they're with and what they're doing and what they think. Each time they do, trust grows another point. Then as we ask them to understand our emotions and they listen, the points add up. When we share our faults, trust grows further. But trust fluctuates. If they fail to understand us, or they mislead us, or they betray us, our level of trust sinks and needs to be rebuilt. When we overcome a challenge together, trust grows again. We begin to trust them with our plans and dreams. And finally, we trust them enough to share our trauma with them. When our trust is high, we feel a love that is physically and emotionally safe and secure. Our partner becomes the person we turn to with good news and bad news, knowing that they'll be on our side and by our side, helping us to weather challenges and celebrate successes. Try this. Daily trust. One of my favorite ways to show trust every day is to notice and recognize when someone follows through on a promise. Often we reward people with thanks and gratitude when they surprise us with a nice gesture. Your partner prepares a delicious dinner that you didn't expect, and you heap on the gratitude. We do the same when they do something that they rarely do. But trust comes with quiet reliability. What about the partner who makes dinner for us regularly? We should show our appreciation for the efforts that they make daily. The more you reward it, the more they'll repeat it. And we build their trust in us the same way by showing up. This week, make an effort to thank your partner for the effort and energy they consistently bring to your partnership. Be specific. Instead of saying, "Thanks for listening," you can say, "I know I always come home and unload my emotions from work on you. I really appreciate how you listen and give me helpful advice." Love brings us through all of these phases over and over again. We never stop deepening our faith in each other. We endlessly find our attraction renewed. We work to remove impurities. Love means that we're happy to go through this cycle together. Now the dreams that you had in phase two are real. They may be different, they're probably better than anything you dared to dream. Instead of fantasizing in your head, you can try out new dreams together. Try this. Build realistic dreams together. Establish a monthly check-in. Commit an hour every month to talk about your relationship. This gives you an opportunity to reaffirm what's working and redirect what's not working. Identify a highlight. What are you grateful for? This helps you both know what's going well. Identify a challenge. What are you struggling with? This helps you see what needs work. Find something to work toward together this coming month. It could be a date night, a birthday celebration, a trip, a plan to redo a room in the home. You can look through a website to research a vacation you want to take. This way, you're building your dreams together. Together, you're working on how you want your relationship to look and feel. To experience all that relationships have to offer means facing the challenges and rewards of every stage of love. Sometimes people jump from relationship to relationship because they're trying to avoid the challenges that love requires. You could date someone new every 3 months and have a lot of fun. But there is no growth in the cycle of just flirting, hooking up, and ditching. It is this ongoing growth and understanding that helps us sustain the fun of love, the connection of love, the trust of love, the reward of love. If we never commit, we'll never get to love. Once in a place of trust and commitment, you and your partner reveal yourselves to each other and share more of yourselves than you allow anyone else to see. This exchange puts you in a unique position. We don't usually think of relationships in terms of learning and teaching, but that is exactly what we will explore in the next chapter: how to learn from and teach our partner. Rule 4. Your partner is your guru. Love does not consist of gazing at each other, but in looking outward together in the same direction. Antoine de Saint-Exupéry. There is an old Zen story about a young man who, looking for a teacher, decided to visit two ashrams. At the first, he approached the guru there, bowed and said, "I am looking for a guru. Do you think you can teach me?" The guru smiled. "Of course. I think you would be a wonderful student, and I would be delighted to share my wisdom with you." Then the young man visited the second ashram, approached the guru there, and bowed. "I am looking for a guru. Do you think you can teach me?" The guru bowed back to him, but shook his head. "Really, I know very little," he said. "But if you'd like to come back later, perhaps we can sit together and watch the sunset." The young man smiled and nodded, then chose the second guru. When I introduced the Vedic life stages, I mentioned that each of them is referred to as an ashram. Ashrams are often associated with a revered teacher, a guru. Since ancient times, people have traveled from all over the world to learn from spiritual teachers, such as Ramakrishna or Neem Karoli Baba, or to Dharamshala to learn from the Dalai Lama in his temple there. A guru is beyond a teacher, guide, or coach. They're like the captain of a ship who helps you cross the turbulent ocean of life with deep compassion and friendship. In the ashram, the teacher sat at the back of the classroom and listened to the students. They asked for feedback after they taught their classes. We weren't assigned our gurus, we chose them. A single teacher to take us on as their student and protege. And they chose us. In school, before I went to the ashram, I struggled with authority. Maybe it was the fault of my ego, but I felt judged and criticized by my teachers. In contrast, the teachers I met as a monk were full of compassion, empathy, and humility. Early in my monkhood, I was in London with my guru, Radhanath Swami. We were staying in quarters close to the temple, and I was seeing to his meals and other needs. Nonetheless, every day the first thing he did when he saw me was to kneel down before me, touching his head to the ground. He was nearly 70 years old, and I was only 22, the new kid on the block, but he was paying respect to the soul or spiritual force within me. He would never say, "You're my disciple, so do this." He never played the guru card. And I would never say, "You're my guru, you should be figuring this out for me." I never played the student card. Each of us approached the other with awe and reverence. A committed romantic relationship highlights this awe and respect in a different way because there isn't one guru and one student. You are both gurus and students for each other. We don't usually think about our partners as teachers or guides, but none of us can see ourselves or the world clearly on our own. We know from our reflections in solitude that each of us sees the world and each other through a different telescope with a limited range. Psychology researcher Jeremy Dean at University College London says that typically we form our concept of how others see us based on how we see ourselves, which is inherently flawed. From the view inside our heads, we are the center of our own world and everything we experience is in some way related to us. Psychologists call this egocentric bias. That's not narcissism, it's just what comes from viewing the world through a single lens. Others see us differently, through their perceptions. Granted, our partners have their own biases, but learning to see ourselves through their eyes both expands and fine-tunes our own perception of ourselves. Your partner is like a mirror held in front of you. This mirror isn't meant to make you feel bad and shouldn't have that effect. When you can't hide from someone, this makes you more transparent and aware of what you need to work on. There is no judgment or force, but support and encouragement while you work on yourself. Your partner should be someone you want to learn with and learn from and learn through and vice versa. We learn with someone when we try something new together and reflect on it afterward. We learn from someone when they have expertise they share with us or use to guide us. Learning through someone is the hardest. In living with another person's mind, heart, and energy, we grow through observing their behavior toward us. We need to have the attention and patience to process their behavior and figure out the lesson it's teaching us. This is particularly hard if they're annoying us. We assume it's their fault instead of realizing that their actions and our reactions are educating us about ourselves. At the same time, we offer lessons to our partner through our behavior and actions toward them. This shared journey is the heart of the Grihastha Ashram, the second stage of life. As a guru, we think about how our actions impact our partner. A guru offers guidance without judgment, wisdom without ego, love without expectation. Being a guru for your partner doesn't mean imparting wisdom to them. That sounds unpleasant at best, but it does require patience, understanding, curiosity, creativity, and self-control. You can't grow these qualities in a vacuum. Your partner is the best person to help you learn them. Although monks' relationships with one another aren't romantic, living in a communal space meant we couldn't hide much from one another. Everyone knew if you kept yourself clean. Everyone knew the quality of your meditation. Long-term relationships are similar, but each person is even more exposed than we monks were. Your partner knows everything about you, the good and the bad. Anyone you encounter might have something to teach you, but not everyone is your guru. Our best friends, closest family, and fellow monks, for those of us who have them, can't help us learn these lessons because they can't see us as completely as the people we love romantically. A close colleague might appreciate my successes more than my wife, but never have met my family. A friend might be better company at a soccer game, but I don't want to go home to him every night. A roommate, like the monks, will certainly see most of the good and bad, but might not be invested enough to help me work through my challenges. My friends and family might have varying levels of respect for my spiritual practice, but Radhi is the one who knows if I actually meditated this morning. She sees me more often and in more contexts than anyone else. Nobody is better positioned to help me become better. When I was fortunate enough to have a breakthrough in my career about a year into our marriage, Radhi didn't seem to care very much. She didn't celebrate it. She had agreed to move with me to New York because she believed in me. But there I was having this great moment, and when she didn't seem impressed, I started wondering, why doesn't my wife respect me? I was sure she loved me. We met when I had nothing. She had other options. She told me she loved me in many ways. But my material success wasn't having the effect on her that I expected. And then I thought about how earlier that same year, when we were 4 months from going broke, I had told her I'd figure it out. Her response was, "I trust you." I realized I didn't want or need her to love me for my achievements. I didn't need her to validate me. It's easy to respect success. She was offering me something greater, her unconditional support and faith in me. That meant more than her celebrating my external success ever could. Radhi's disregard for material success helped me develop the quality of loving myself for my values. She taught me this without meaning to. She never said, "I love you for your values." I grappled with this all on my own. This is how we are each other's gurus without training, trying, or even realizing we're doing it. Radhi didn't even realize I'd learned the lesson until years later I told her. I was so lucky that she fell in love with me when we had nothing. If I had already had a certain level of recognition, I definitely would have made the mistake of wanting a wife who would appreciate my success more. Relationships are for growth. If we choose a partner we can grow with, then they are always teaching us. Researchers Arthur and Elaine Aron developed self-expansion theory, which states that relationships, especially the one with our partner, enable us to live a bigger, richer life by expanding our sense of self. Self-expansion theory says we're motivated to partner with someone who brings to the relationship things we don't already have, such as different skills. You know how to unclog a drain. Personality traits, you're the life of the party. And perspectives, you grew up overseas. Our partner expands our sense of who we are because they expand the resources to which we have access. The most common complaints I hear people make about their partners are, in essence, that they don't do what they want them to do. She doesn't do her share of the household chores. He's rude to my parents. They never give me compliments. He forgets my birthday. But if you think your partner should do what you want, when you want, I want to change how you look at your partner. That's not a relationship. That's ownership. Ownership is born of control. We definitely don't want that dynamic with our partner. A good partnership is transactional. Transactions are part of getting along with another person. We figure out schedules, we coordinate responsibilities, we balance our lives. But a great relationship needs more than transactions. It needs growth. Love is not just compliance or trade. Love is working through it together. We touched on this in the last rule when we looked at the third stage of love, disappointment, and revelation. In this chapter, we'll talk about how you learn from each other most by overcoming challenges together. Life becomes more enjoyable when you know each other, watch each other grow, and grow together. We say we want to grow old together, but we forget to give significance to the growing part. The guru/student dynamic is what makes you feel like you're connected to your partner. You have to put effort into a relationship in order to get something out of it, but it's not a vending machine. You can't put in effort and expect an immediate, guaranteed reward. What you invest will have to be heartfelt and true, and what you receive will be illuminating. Try this. Assess whether your partner is someone you can learn and grow with. Even when we're just getting to know someone, we can spot signs that they're more than a fun companion, that they would be a good partner to grow with. If you ask yourself these questions, you'll be surprised at how much you already know about your partner's capacity to learn with you. For each question, rate whether your partner does it always, sometimes, or never. 1. Do they like learning about themselves? If someone isn't curious about learning about themselves, they may struggle to learn about you. If someone has a passion for growing, they'll help you grow. Do they like to try new things? Are they self-aware? Are they open to therapy or coaching or other ways of self-development? Do they like having conversations about how they make decisions or choices? 2. Do they understand their own emotions? Is your partner good at understanding and expressing their emotions? Do they talk about their day on a superficial level only, or do they share emotions in a real way? When they tell a story, is their emotional state part of it? 3. Do they try to understand you? Are they curious about you? Self-awareness often, but not always, leads to curiosity about others. Do they use their emotional skills to better understand you? if they haven't got into a place where they can expand their radius of care and love, it means they are still in brahmacharya. They are still a student of themselves and not ready to learn with you. 4. Can they entertain themselves? It's easier to learn with another person if they love solitude. It means they have their own journey and their own path, which allows you to travel your own path beside them. 5. Are they open to finding new ways of solving problems? For example, if they're having trouble with a colleague, do they talk to you or a friend about it? Are they willing to talk to the colleague to propose a compromise or to shift gears by asking the person out to lunch? Learning and growing means having the determination and flexibility to address issues from new angles. That inclination is transferable to a relationship. 6. Do they support others in their growth? Look to see if they make the effort to support a friend, a sibling, or a mentee. Is helping others a part of their life? This shows you that they can extend their radius of love and care as is necessary in Grihastha. 7. Do they inspire you to be better and more? A partner can make you feel ambitious, not to impress them, but because they believe in your abilities and give you the confidence to follow your interests and inclinations. Your answers to this assessment don't make or break your relationship. Look at the questions to which you responded never or sometimes. This tells you the areas where you need to take the lead. If your partner never spends time in solitude, understand that this is something you'll have to either accept or encourage them to start in ways that appeal to them. You might come up with activities that will help them spend time reflecting. See the try this exercises in Rule 1. Or they might have low self-awareness that will impact your relationship. If they don't try to understand you, you have to gently educate them about how you work, saying things like, "When I'm tired after work, I have a shorter fuse. Let's save figuring out our finances for the weekend." When we enroll in a class or rent an Airbnb, we research it before we commit. Exercises like this are research into our relationship. A partner who doesn't check all these boxes could still develop into someone with whom you want to learn and grow, if you're open to teaching each other. Become a better guru. In the Guru and Disciple book, Kripa Moya Das talks about how traditional spiritual gurus and their students help one another. He lists 14 qualities of the guru that were first described by the medieval philosopher Vedanta Deshika. I've included the Sanskrit descriptions and Kripa Moya Das's translations of some of these qualities to show how the qualities of the teacher and the student that I describe are grounded in scripture. Do not lead, serve. One of the guru qualities that Kripa Moya Das lists is Dambha Asuyadi Muktam, which means exhibits no inauspicious characteristics such as egoism or jealousy. Remember how my guru, Radhanath Swami, bowed down on the floor in front of me? A guru doesn't lord his position over his student or try to control them. Zen master Shunryu Suzuki was set to visit the Cambridge Buddhist Association in Massachusetts, arriving on a Wednesday evening. The day before, several members started cleaning the house in preparation for the visit. They were cleaning the meditation room when the doorbell rang. It was Suzuki Roshi arriving a day early. When he saw what they were doing, he smiled, tied up the sleeves of his robes, and joined in the cleaning. The next day, he found a ladder and started scrubbing the windows. A guru doesn't hesitate to play any position if it helps their student. There is no ego involved. the guru is honored and grateful to support another. A real guru doesn't want power, but empowers their partner. The guru is not trying to command, demand, or force their partner to do anything or be a certain way. Instead of saying, "You should do this," the guru says, "I'd love to share this idea with you," or, "Have you ever thought of it this way?" In the ashram, if a monk didn't wake up on time, their guru wouldn't yell, "What's wrong with you? Why didn't you show up at morning meditation?" Rather, they might say, "Did you sleep well? Is there any way I can help you?" The guru is focused on the behavior's cause, not its consequence. In the Marvel movie Doctor Strange, Surgeon Stephen Strange is a self-important narcissist. Then an accident severely damages his hands, leaving him unable to perform surgery. Desperate to regain his abilities, he travels to Nepal in search of a teacher called the Ancient One. When Strange arrives, he sees an older man with glasses and a long goatee sitting reading a book. "Thank you, Ancient One, for seeing me," he says. The woman pouring Strange's tea stands up. "You're welcome," she says. His education has begun. The Ancient One shows him a chakra chart, and he dismisses it, saying he's seen it in gift shops. Then, after forcing Strange to experience alternate dimensions, the Ancient One asks, "Have you ever seen that before in a gift shop?" Strange, in awe, says, "Teach me." The Ancient One just says no. Our guru's powers aren't so vast, and our lessons may not be so succinct, but the point is that when your partner sees you aren't trying to control or assert authority over them, you bolster their trust and confidence. Set a good example. Another guru quality that Kripamoya Das lists is sthira dhyam, meaning that the mind remains firmly fixed even in difficult situations. This means the guru should try to behave in an exemplary way. "Radhi wanted me to go to the gym and to eat right, but she didn't nag me about it. Rather, she guided me to a healthier lifestyle by living it herself. She doesn't cut corners in her own practice, and I wouldn't have switched my habits if she hadn't been so consistent in her own commitment." The guru doesn't model good habits because they're trying to preach or instruct or brag, but because it makes them joyful and happy. I have a client who complained that his wife spent too much money on bags and shoes. But when I asked him about his own spending, he admitted that he had just bought a fancy new car. She'd have to buy hundreds of shoes and bags to come close to the cost of that car. So he was imposing standards on her that he wasn't adhering to himself. If he was worried about their finances, he could suggest that they both start monitoring their spending habits, but he couldn't impose his values on her spending without reining in his own. The guru will never ask the student to do something they're not comfortable doing themselves. They lead by example. Saint Francis said, "It is no use walking anywhere to preach unless our walking is our preaching." When you lead by example, you come to understand how difficult it is to grow because you're doing the hard work of growth yourself. This gives you compassion and empathy toward your partner rather than judgment and expectations. Support their goals, not yours. Dayalam is the guru's quality of having spontaneous compassion and kindness for students. I expand this to suggest that the guru should make sure they support the student's own path. There is a story in Bhakti scripture about a stone bridge being built over the sea between India and Sri Lanka. All the animals help build the bridge. The strong monkey god Hanuman is chucking massive rocks and boulders into the growing structure. He notices that the squirrel, eager to do his share, is throwing little pebbles in the same direction. Hanuman sneers at the squirrel. How is that even going to make a difference? Then, Lord Ram, the virtuous prince overseeing the project, steps in. He says, "You are each doing the most you can according to your capacity. The rock is equal to the pebble." He points out that pebbles help the boulders stay in place and thanks the squirrel for his efforts. We take pride in noticing our partner's potential and urging them to fulfill it, but we don't want to impose our goals on them. Our goal is simply to help them get to the next step in their journey, not the next step in our vision of what their journey should be. If our partner wants to learn to meditate, we might find an app or a nearby center where they can begin their practice, but we don't tell them how often they should meditate or what they should expect from it. If our partner has a conflict with a family,